Hello everyone and welcome back to the NBL Pocket Podcast. This is episode 16, a game 1 and 2 grand final review of those games with Borty Notch. Hopefully you will enjoy it. Just a couple of things before we start this episode. Obviously I'm on Twitter. You can find me at NBL Pocket Pod, P-O-D, on Twitter. At YouTube, you can just type in NBL Pocket Podcast. And then Gmail, if you have any like larger questions that you can't get to me on Twitter about or that you want to keep private, nblpocketpodcast@gmail.com. You must be listening to this on Apple Podcasts or iTunes. That's the only place it's available. The podcast will soon be available on Spotify as well. I've requested it to be hosted there as well, and I'm just waiting for it to be processed. As I said, this is one that Borty and I went over. We did. We talked about game 1 and 2, obviously, in particular the Wildcat bench, the officiating, Trevor Gleeson's game 2 rotations, the third quarter, the championship quarter in this series so far, DJ Kennedy and Mitch McCarron's rebounding, and we both sort of spoke about how much we enjoy and really have a higher opinion of Venti Joyce's game, who's coming off deeply off the Melbourne bench. And his future with the club and in the NBL. And then obviously Botti tells a nice little story about when he spoke to Brian Gorgian a year or two ago about what his return to the NBL would look like, or at least what he said at that time, because obviously there's the speculation he'll return as Sydney King head coach. Guys, before we get into this as well, I just want to talk about a couple of Twitter accounts that if you're new to the NBL or kind of looking for something to follow along with to the games if you're watching by yourself and you want a bit of feedback for stuff. These are Twitter accounts that I follow and do check during the quarter breaks at the NBL just to get a better idea of what to look at, and also just when I'm poking around as well. Those accounts are Liam Santa Maria at Liam Santa. He's one of the best analytical analysts of the NBL working today, along with Tom Hirsch as well, and that's at Tom, T-O-M Hirsch, but it's spelled H-E-R-S-Z, and again, him and Liam Santa Maria are probably the two best analytical analyzers of the NBL out there. Another one is Olgun Ulluk. I hope I'm pronouncing his name right. O-L-G-U-N-U-L-U-C. He's really great for league news and, I don't want to say rumor, but certainly speculation about player movement and injury and things like that. He's very dependable. The best anecdotal guys on Twitter and the internet are the Trash Talk, the basketball, the Sports Bet Basketball Trash Talk podcast. I forget the exact name of it. Felix Hoff, Wurtho33, and of course, Corey Homicide, C-Homicide. If you haven't followed those three guys, definitely do that. And then some two perhaps lesser known Twitter accounts that are really good to follow. One is at Coach Duncan Berg, B-E-R-G. This gentleman is really mathematical in his dissection of the game and super observant as well. I really enjoyed his thoughts and comments on game 2. So he's definitely one to follow as well, and he's quite communicative as well. So if you ask him a question, he will answer it as best he can. And then the other one is at Emma Turner, B-A. She's a nice Twitter account to follow, very funny, very positive, and has got some really timely retweets and discovers a bit of stuff online and posts it and retweets it and things, so definitely worth following. Obviously, Borty and I speak about a number of things. One thing we didn't really get to, or that I wanted to clarify a bit further close to this, I might be doing a podcast exclusively looking at Game 3, because as we later go on to discuss, that this is this game 3 coming up on Friday is the biggest game of the series. Whoever wins this game 3, we both believe will win the series, and Botty and I both believe it's going to be Perth to win this one. But nonetheless, I might do a podcast delving into it a bit more, but if that goes up, it'll be in the obvious places. Just quickly, the sports bet odds for game 3, Perth are $1.60 and Melbourne are $2.35, so that's for game 3. Game 1, however, Perth were $1.72 and Melbourne were $2.15, so the odd makers like Perth even more now going into this game 3 than they did in game 1. And then outright, Perth are $1.80 and Melbourne are $2 to win the whole thing, so still pretty tight. But I just found it interesting that the odds have actually shortened for Perth to win. Now, obviously, the less games you take off a series and they have the home court and they're holding serve, they've done everything they're supposed to, the odds would naturally trim. But yeah, it's just interesting going to this game three. I think Perth are going to win. However, Melbourne could very, very comfortably win. I think the biggest thing is McCarron and Kennedy getting hurt in game one, and McCarron getting the fouls in game one. So if those two can relax and play like they did in Melbourne, I really do think they're the key to the series. I think Casper and Cotton have played each other to a bit of a stalemate. And then obviously Chris Goulding, I'm still waiting on specific clarification of the pronunciation of his surname. They've kind of played themselves a little bit to a standstill. Obviously, I'm going to go with Goulding. Goulding could shoot it like crazy and turn this game three. He's the danger man for this one. But yeah, really interesting game three. Finals MVP. I think it'll be either Casper Ware or Bryce Cotton. But some long odds that might be fun. These are courtesy of sportsbet.com.au. So let's say you think fine. I think whoever wins the series is going to get the best MVP. Whichever team wins is going to have the MVP. And I think some nice long shots that if you're betting and you might want to have a bit of fun with. Perth, Nick Kay's $5.50. Bryce is under $2. I think he's $1.95, I think. So he's a nice little long shot. Cheeky little tenner, might be nice to get 50 back. And then the other one, that this is an especially long shot, but you know, he's a guy who's played well in game one, not so great in game two, is Damian Martin. He's $34. Again, long shot, but that's why the numbers are what they are. I think he's a chance to get it, and I'll tell you why I think he's a chance to get it after I go through Melbourne's Seng stock medal likelihoods. I think the one at this stage who's pretty good money at $5 is DJ Kennedy. I think people have a pretty short-term memory about his game one. And I don't think there was also a clear Melbourne United who would have got the most votes out of that game as well. So, but he had that such great game too, and was named Bunnings Player of the Game. So, all thoughts are that he was the leader in that game. And then the long shot for Melbourne, and this is the one I like the most, is Mitch McCarron at $34. And I say that for two reasons. One, had a bad game one, which hurts his chances, but had a really good game two, in which he could have finished second to Kennedy if the voters are a little bit lenient towards locals. And the big reason why I say Damian Martin and McCarron are a decent chance at those long odds is you look at the judges of the Seng Stock medal. You've got Larry Seng Stock himself, Brett Maher, Chris Anstey, Rob Beveridge, Liam Santa Maria, Craig O'Donoghue. So, and Craig O'Donoghue. So you've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 guys in total, four of which are still sort of involved in the game. Larry Seng Stock himself was interviewed at, I think, for sort of halftime of the game one or two. I can't recall. I think it was game two. In which he said, "Oh, who do you like watching?" He says, "Mitch McCarron." You know, it's not, you know, maybe he just likes watching him. It doesn't mean he's going to vote for him for the medal, but, you know, good omen, good something in the air. You look there, like Seng Stock, Brett Maher, Anstey, Beveridge, who's not a player but coach, you know, they're all involved in the game, either as a player or still involved in the game. I think they're just likely to sort of see contributions from players that aren't as obvious, you know, like obvious choice is Cotton, obvious choice is Casper Ware and Chris Goulding. But maybe they see something that's a little bit beyond that, especially in such a sort of tight, I use this word, grubbery series that we've had. There hasn't been a huge standout scoring performance from anyone. You know, it's a matter of looking in and seeing merit in a player. So maybe they go with that. And then Santa Maria and O'Donoghue, I think they're pretty analytical. They'll go with the best player. So, you know, interesting to see a couple of things. But more importantly is the interview I did with Boti. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. It's coming up now. And enjoy that. Thanks very much.
Quickly, how are things?
They are very good, thank you. Very pleasant. Yeah, my Premier League team had its opening game on Friday night. We won. So I'm 1-0 as a coach at the moment, so I'm pretty happy.
Oh, well done.
Ready to retire.
Yeah. And obviously you watched the games over the weekend?
Yeah, I did.
You enjoy them?
I did. Not greatly.
You didn't think the standard was great?
We're still off here. I thought they were disappointing after halftime, both games, for different reasons. But, you know, very similar sort of scenarios played out where, yeah. So I didn't enjoy them as much as I thought I would. I must say, I do admit that I enjoyed the Perth win more than I enjoyed the Melbourne win.
And why was that?
I don't know. I don't know. I wasn't really barracking for either, but no. I just, the way it was constructed and the way they did it, I just enjoyed it more.
I think it also sets up a better series, obviously. If they lose that one, the series kind of falls over a little bit. But obviously winning it. I mean, my question from game one is, did anything like stand out for you as far as a Perth performance or Melbourne, what they did?
I was disappointed in Melbourne, to be honest. I thought a lot of guys didn't show up. And when we're in playoff situation, you have to show up. That's what you're getting paid the money for. Mm. It's no good being a superstar when you're beating somebody down the lower end of the ladder. You got to stand up when it matters. And I thought there were a number of Melbourne players that didn't do that.
I thought the one who I was kind of cheering for was Jesse Wagstaff, who I thought we'd had an up and down year, and I thought had a really good game one. Just came in, shot well, end of story. Yep. Defended well, end of story. But I think the thing I took away from it was Nick Kaye. Had a very kind of, you look at the box score and it doesn't jump out at you, but I just thought he's had his fingerprints all over it.
Yeah, I think Nick is the secret to success with Perth, to be honest. He's had a great season. I picked him for my All-Star 5 a month out from when it was ticked. Actually, I got the All-Star 5 correct. And so I was really pleased. I thought he was the standout power forward in the league. And when people would go on about, and they're still going on about, Perth necessity for a third import. I'm thinking, have you seen the sort of form that Nick Kaye's in? Are you seeing what he's delivering?
Yeah, I think you said it in the last time we spoke, and I really kind of looked into it. I was like, yeah, like his consistent high play is that of a top line import, especially compared to some of the imports this year. I won't name any of them, but his production's been nearly double in some cases.
Yeah, so it's like, are you paying attention? And like even after they win game one, it's like, well, they won't win the series, and if they don't, it's because they don't have a third import. It's like the people that latched onto that in the commentary and in the quote expert unquote area believe that they just want that to be true. They're just wishing for that to be true, and no matter what, they want to say that. And it's like, it isn't true. Look at what they're doing. And if it is true, then six other clubs, what were they doing thinking with three? It's like, it's a nonsense.
I was actually underwhelmed by the commentary as well. I just thought, first of all, it's a moot point. You can't bring in a third import. So,
and then
secondly, you got the Nick Kaye argument. And thirdly, it's just sort of lazy. Like, look at what's on the floor. I was shocked at the end of game two when there was a bit of blank and dead air. I thought, talk about what we've seen in not only the game you're just watching, but also game one, and then how that's going to translate into a game three, four, and five.
Yep.
I was a little bit underwhelmed.
And you had every right to be. I think game three becomes absolutely the essential game now, because if Perth wins that, then I think Perth wins the series, because I can't see I can't see Melbourne winning a game five in Perth.
I agree. I mean, that's actually one of my questions coming in. Yeah, that game three. I mean, I actually read your writing on your website, how you'd said that sort of like game one and three.
Yep.
Do you think it's easier, or not easier is probably not the word I want to use, but like to win a game one or a game three? Obviously, Melbourne lost that game one. Did that critically change the series for you, the fact that they didn't win that one and now it comes down to game three?
I do. I really expected that would be the one that they would have all guns blazing for, because that's the one where you're playing with house money, because, if you lose, you're supposed to lose.
Yeah.
So there's no, you're really playing without any kind of pressure. Whereas in game three, now they're under pressure. They have to win game three, realistically, to win the championship. So I think that was the difference, that in game one, they should have played with a lot more abandon and a lot more freedom and played a better second half of basketball. And they didn't do that. And so they've thrown the pressure onto themselves in game three more so than onto Perth. So that's the difference between the one and three scenarios. I mean, obviously they get that game, it changes everything. But I would have thought that game one would have been an easier one to get, especially when you have the memory of the double overtime loss in Perth and the Casper Ware miss in Perth. And you're thinking, we're right on their toes. We just play our best game and we get this and we're in the box seat. So that's where I was a little bit disappointed in Melbourne, but impressed with Perth, because they just basically flew in the face of all the Eastern States experts that have been waiting
It's a bit like the AFL. Yeah. We're waiting for West Coast to fall over because, you know, hey, you can't beat this powerhouse team over here that we see all the time. And there's not enough credit given to the Perths and Adelaides and New Zealands of this world.
I think so too. I think also the other thing with the winning the game one is fatigue is going to play a huge factor in this series just because of the schedule. Game on a Friday, fly to Melbourne or Perth on a Sunday. I think as you go on, I mean, obviously game three, there's going to be this big break. But I still thought everyone was fresh after that two-week break. That was the time to just really slam it. Now you've got... Do you think Dave Barlow looked a little hurt? There's a lot of talk about him being hurt in...
He had a pretty good first half.
Yeah.
Like in game two, we're talking there, he had a pretty good first half and not so effective second half. But he was good in the first. So, and then other players stepped up. So maybe he'd done enough, and maybe he is a bit hurt, and they need to nurse him a bit. But honestly, Joseph, at this end of the year, who's not hurt? Which player out there isn't carrying something? It hasn't got some sort of niggle, or whether it's an ankle or the way your shoulder feels, or, you know, like this is the business end, and you can't hang your hat on that. I mean, what I think is in Perth's favour is that Mitch Norton has a little bit longer now to get back to being Mitch Norton, not the injury recovery guy, but the guy that can actually contribute.
Yeah.
And I think that again looks good for the Wildcats.
My next question is, can the Wildcat bench contribute on the road? And also, I guess, a subsection of those, does it need to? Like, can they
If they can perform, if Jesse can perform, particularly Jesse Wagstaff, can step up the way he did in game one, where he looked like, you know, the, quote, final specialist, unquote, where what he did was super effective. If he can deliver that in game three, then doesn't it become moot in game four? Because, again, now if they were to win game three, as I expect that they will, then they go into Melbourne and they're playing with house money. So they can just relax and go for it. And if they don't get it, doesn't matter. You still come home with the safety net of game five, and beating Perth in game five in Perth is going to take a fair effort. So if it becomes a moot point, as you say, because game four doesn't really matter.
Yeah.
But game four could just be that one where everyone is a bit relaxed. If they're coming in 2-1, you're feeling good about yourself, and maybe you do play a great game. There's no pressure on you.
Yeah, it's true.
I mean, there is. I mean, obviously, it's a grand final. There's pressure, but we're talking about the psychological aspects of it, where you go, okay, and that's why I thought that game one was the one that Melbourne really needed to get. And then that would have sent a real message, a shot across the bow sort of thing for Perth, but they didn't get it done. And again, the margins to me are irrelevant because it is just 1-1.
Yeah.
The margins are only relevant, I think, if somebody really whacks the other team, you know, and sends a message, much like the semi-finals when both. Brisbane won there.
Yeah.
Perth whacked Brisbane by 30.
Yeah.
You thought, well, that's going to take a lot for them to recover from that psychologically. Similarly, Melbourne smacks Sydney by 20 plus, and it's like they're going to have to dig out of a big hole. So that's when the margin does play a part in a best of series, when you whack somebody. But I don't really expect this to be that sort of thing. Like, okay, you're falling behind, you can't win the game, so now are you going as hard as you might be if it was
there was a big element of that game one.
Yes. Yeah. And similarly game two. So I don't think you can take much out of that. If both teams are playing flat chat all the way to the siren and there's nothing in it, but in terms of you're playing your best people and you still get whacked by 25, then you've sent a message.
Right.
But that's not happening.
My question, there's a lot of sort of... stuff about the officiating game one and two. What did you think?
Look, I think the NBL likes the idea of two heavyweight teams going five games.
Yeah.
I think it does. Of course, it's good for business. It's good for everything.
Yeah.
And while I would be shocked beyond belief if there was any sort of suggestion of impropriety on behalf of, there's no way that happens, that they go down to the refs and say, hey, we want 1, 2, and 3.
Yeah.
But referees are only human, and they are also conscious of the fact
paid per game.
That Yeah, five games is what the league would like to see. Now, whether that subliminally influences them, whether the home crowds, I mean, I know there are some refs in that panel that we've seen before, yeah, that do like a little bit of crowd adulation. Yeah. And, you know, so if you're playing in front of, you know, 10,000-plus people on any given night, you like them to be cheering for you.
Yeah,
so
sure.
I think subliminally they may be impacted, but I would be shocked beyond belief
I thought both teams had there were 50-50 calls, and they went whichever way they went, you know. So the charge on Casper Ware, I think, was one, or the cotton, the block charge on Casper Ware, you know, and then Tariqa White had a foul in this game too. So there were sort of 50-50 calls. Very few of them were in scoring position. A lot of people saying, oh, you know, these calls change momentum. I thought, gee, they'd have to be pretty fickle teams to have these calls affect their game, and they don't seem to be very fickle because they've come this far. I didn't see a problem.
No, I just think if there is that 50-50 call that goes with the home team, you just wear that because
that's what the regular season's about, I think.
Yes, absolutely, is to get that advantage so that you do have 13,000 people, or in the case of Sydney in their last game, 14,500 people trying to influence the outcome.
Exactly.
That's supposed to happen.
Yeah, I think so too. My question then is, Cairns were the only team to beat Perth and Perth, Melbourne and Melbourne. Do you have a sort of a reasoning for that as to how they did that?
No, I don't want to detract from Cairns because I think Cairns did great. Once the year flipped over, once it went from the 2018-19, once we went onto the other side of the hyphen, I thought Cairns was very good.
Yeah.
But given what happened before the hyphen, I think there could have been a slight tendency for two teams that are in a grand final now to maybe have not had the foot on the pedal.
I don't think it was any particular strategy from either.
No.
I remember them being remember the fourth quarter of the Wildcat game being dog days. That was just really just. I don't think Cairns scored a field goal in the last 5 minutes. Now maybe I've got the wrong game, but I remember it just being a real fall over the line. But Cairns kind of did improve that mid-season onwards.
No question. But the thing is that if you go into in our league, when people say it all the time, and it becomes a bit of a cliche that any team can be any team on any given night. And of course, that should be true of sport all the time anyway.
Yeah.
But the reality is that after a while, you don't expect certain teams to beat you.
Yeah.
Because you've seen, you know, that they lost 10 in a row, 15 or whatever it was. You know, you sort of go, okay. And if you do not go in with the correct mindset, then at quarter time when you're trailing or you haven't got your game, you're not in sync, it's really hard to get it back. And the other team gets a sniff and starts to think, hey, you know, we could get this. And suddenly your record or where you sit on the ladder becomes irrelevant. And I think that, you know, when you say, okay, Cairns was the only team to win in Perth and Melbourne, good luck to them. What are they doing now?
Yeah, true. Game one and game two, but we'll specify on game one. Melbourne's turnovers. Melbourne had 15 to 11 in that game one. Were they a result of, do you think, carelessness, or was there sort of a defensive design by Perth to manufacture those turnovers? And the reason I ask is just because of the points from turnovers discrepancy, Perth seemed to be getting Melbourne to turn it over in a position that then resulted in scores. Did you see a design there?
Look, I give Perth a lot of credit because Perth played what they like to call, and what we all sort of, the rest of the world outside of Western Australia, you know, we all just sort of roll our eyes at. But they did play Wildcats basketball. Mm. They did. And that's what it is. It comes from a defensive base. It comes from a physical base. And so they were capable of creating some turnovers. But I just thought Melbourne's mindset after half time was lacking, and I don't think it's rare in a grand final for people to be careless with the ball.
Yeah,
so I don't think it was so much carelessness as just they weren't in that frame of mind that we're going to get this game, and they really should have been. As we spoke previously, you know, you come in on that game one, you got nothing to lose. No one's expecting you to win, and so but that didn't exist for them. They didn't have that. Perth was going about business.
Yeah.
We're taking care of business. That's all they were doing. And I've got to say, in game two, Melbourne looked very similar. We're taking care of business. We're supposed to win here. We're taking care of business. But you've got to win in Perth if you want to win a championship, if you're United. And geez, Friday's going to be so interesting.
Friday, if they, I mean, I think they're going to be up for it. I think I mean, yeah, we spoke about this last time, but yeah, they've come close a bunch of times, and I don't think there's any reason why they couldn't if they're engaged.
Yeah, but also if the Perth bench isn't as active, yes, and as influential, you know, okay, maybe I haven't looked at Tom Jervis's numbers, but I like the way he was playing. Yeah,
yeah, I agree. Yeah.
Again, another guy that hasn't had a great year, but hey, all the cookies are on the line, and he's in there.
It was the blocks. I mean, I think they averaged sort of, you know, two or three blocks a game in the season, and then had eight or nine in game one. They were just swatting
it. Yeah.
And everyone too. Like, I think Nick Kay got a couple, but outside of him in the starting lineup, it was basically the bench that came in and was swatting stuff out of the house.
There were some beauties too. There really were some
one
gems.
Was fantastic. I love that.
Yeah.
One. Came over on, who was Boone, I think. Rebounding. Game two, obviously Melbourne got Melbourne killed Perth on the boards, 51-38, 20 offensive rebounds to 10. Did Melbourne do something differently to get those rebounds?
I just think they came in with a whole other mindset than they had in West Australia. It was like, we have to win this game, we're going to win this game, let's get on with it. Mm. And they did all the things they're supposed to do. They went to the boards hard, they wanted it.
Yeah.
And yet, you know, I actually thought at halftime that Perth was going to win the game.
Same.
To be completely honest, they're within a point. They haven't been great, but they've been focused. Like, even Greg Hire's minutes,
he grabbed
a couple of big offensive rebounds, created opportunities. I'm thinking, this is the way Perth likes to play.
Yeah.
And if they're going to get that from their bench, they will get this game. So I was quite surprised at the way the second half unfolded, because it was Melbourne saying, no, this is our place. We have to win here, and we're going to get on it. And they got on it. They got on the boards. They did what they had to do. And it was Perth that wilted, which surprised me. I got to tell you.
I think the wilting... Well, like, were you surprised in that third quarter? I saw Damian Martin and Angus Brand. They played the first 4 minutes. They both sat the entire third quarter from the 6.5-minute mark onwards. And it was a bit of a change in Gleeson's rotations from the game one that they won. And they had, I think they had four bench players and Cotton out there the last sort of 3 minutes. And I'm just looking at some of the minutes, like, Martin's numbers were down 3.5. Brandt played 12 minutes less from game one, and then Steindl was up 3.5, and Reece Vaig was up 12 minutes. Were you surprised at the rotation, or did you notice that?
Well, the thing is, we're talking about guys that are a little bit older.
Yeah.
Like, Damo's older, and to have played Friday night, travelled Saturday, and then be playing Sunday.
26 hours between games.
Yeah, exactly. You've got to be mindful of what you can get out of those guys, and at what point they're hitting the wall. So I don't. If that game had been played Monday night, it would be a little bit different. I think you might find. I think Trevor's trying to protect people.
I think it was. I think it was load management. But yeah, and you say it sort of game two. Like, where do we sit? Do we go for this one or not? Knowing you've got game three at home. But I was shocked to see, like, we talk about load management. Like, Angus Brandt's young. He'd be mid to late 20s, is he?
Yep.
And then also, like, I would have thought, seeing what Greg Hire had done. I would have thought, geez, we're getting really kind of killed on the boards here in the third. Let's bring in Greg Hire as opposed to. I mean, you make that call in the day, but.
Yeah. Well, I mean, with Angus, do we know he's 100%? Like, as we said, you know, you get to this point of the season, who is 100%? So, I mean, the situation with Angus is, at this point of the season, you don't know who is at 100%, and probably very few players are. And he has had his issues with the ankle. Maybe, you know, was there a tweak that he needed to have a bit more of a rest?
Right.
I don't know. Sometimes guys ask to come out too.
Yeah, true. I just thought, from what you'd seen of that game, I would have thought Gleeson seemed to have a lot of sort of push on Steindl. It was like, Steindl, go for it. And he didn't have a great shooting game. Did a couple other things, but yeah, really struggled from the outside. And then Reece Vaig over Greg Hire, you know, the decision the coach makes.
Yeah. You know, I like the decision he made just before halftime, putting Vaig in, even though it was for a last play. I thought that was clever, and he might have looked like a genius if Vaig gets the shot.
Yeah.
You gamble, you take chances with people. Sometimes it works, and you're the coach of the year, and sometimes it doesn't work, and you're the jerk of the year. You know?
Speaking of sort of coach of the year, I think that third quarter, that's kind of been where this has blown out. Now, whether it's a matter of just the way the game has gone, or by design, by coaches. Game one, Perth win it 31-14. Game two, Melbourne win it 26-16. Like, I just want to talk more about, like, in the grander sense, like, winning a third quarter. Like, what does a coach Because it really is a mark of a coach who looks at that first half and goes, all right, here are our changes going into the third.
Yep.
And I just want to talk in a grander sense about like what it takes to win a third quarter and whether you think it's going to be a factor in this series.
Well, you've been around long enough to know that in many sports that play across four quarters as opposed to, say, soccer with two halves or whatever, in many, many sports you hear the term the third quarter is the championship quarter or the premiership quarter, and you sort of scratch your head if you're not into sport going, what is that supposed to mean? It's supposed to mean that that's where things are decided. That's where the interval and the coach's adjustments and how the players respond to those adjustments, how they execute what he wants, is the critical factor in how this game may well play out. And so the first, I don't think it's actually the championship quarter so much as the first 5 minutes after halftime will usually give you a really good indication of which team has adjusted and which team has basically thought, okay, we're travelling all right, we'll just stay with what we're doing and maybe get a little bit of a surprise. Because honestly, in game two, I did expect that Perth was going to kick on, and I was quite surprised that they didn't, and that Melbourne, yeah, really took control of the game over the next little while, and yeah, 18-point win. Like I said, the margin doesn't matter that much, but they were, because at some point you put the cue back in the rack and go, okay, game three. So that certainly happened with the Wildcats.
Definitely.
But, look, I don't know. It's also there's a player's mindset, there's a group mindset, there's what the coach is trying to get across. You know, there are situations that occur in basketball games that I find quite fascinating, and there's really not much you can do about it as a coach. Mm-hmm. I'll give you an example, is when your best free throw shooter, like with Adelaide 36ers here in Adelaide that I watch, a Daniel Johnson who gets to the foul line all the time, early in a game, he gets to the foul line and he aborts two. And it's like the next guy that goes to the foul line, Nathan Sobey, one out of two. Yeah. Next guy, it's like the yips and it just goes through a team.
Right.
And it's like, wait a minute, these guys are shooting 100 free throws a day and making in the 90s. What is going on? Yeah. And it's just, it's sort of like a group thing that it just seeps through. So there's a lot of factors at play, and you've really got to have the coach and the team on the very same page for you to get exactly what you want after halftime. And I think in this instance, being at home, being in front of their fans, I think Dean Vickerman got his message through more effectively than Trevor did, which was the exact reverse of game one.
Yeah, do you think any coach has kind of got the sort of edge in the coaching adjustment battle, or is it one for one?
Yeah, I think it's one for one. I don't think I'm reading too much into, I mean, they've got a whole week now. That's what makes game three so interesting, and you're sort of counting down the days, because you want to see what they're going to do. What's Trevor going to do?
Yeah.
What's Dean going to counter with? What's Dean going to do? What's Trevor going to counter with? Because the more games you play against the same opponent, obviously, and they played a game right in the end of the regular season as well, so they're very, very familiar with each other, who makes the adjustments? And then the other question becomes, how big do you want to make? How many big adjustments do you want to make? How far away do you want to go from what got you here? Yes, or made you successful, or do you just have to execute it better? So it's like, yeah, you're kind of waiting and waiting for game three, because that's the one that's going to tell us
everything.
Pretty much everything we need to know. Yep.
Bryce Cotton shot 5 of 10 from the outside. All the rest of the Wildcats, 1 of 18. Do you have any explanation for that? I thought they got open looks, just missed. I don't know.
Yeah. I don't know. I'd, if you knew the answer to that, you know, your team would be the Harlem Globetrotters. Yeah. You'd be undefeated, because it just happens some nights.
I mean, I think what my worry about it is for Perth, who I think have got sort of a stronger hold on the series than Melbourne, not just because of the home court advantage, but because of their play. The worry is, in that game one, Kennedy goes down with the neck and the head injury.
Yep.
Mitch McCarron gets an early foul, trouble. Between them in that game, they had 2 rebounds. In game two, they had 19 between them, 15 of them defensively. I think, I don't know if you agree with this, but when Melbourne, when their rebounding comes from those two, they're a much more dynamic team pushing the ball up the floor than, say, when it comes to Boone, who then hands it off.
Yeah,
Would you concur with that?
Absolutely. I'm seeing Mitch McCarron get an offensive rebound that beats Sydney
during
the regular season. And when Kennedy is a contributor the way he was in game two, right across the board, what did he end up with, 14 rebounds?
Yeah,
12 points, 14 rebounds,
five,
4 assists.
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah, five. Yeah, like that was a really good performance. If he's going to put that in, then Terrico White needs to be given a little bit more you know, because I know they're playing him at the three and then at the four when Barlow goes out, but realistically, you know, you've got to put more pressure on him defensively so that maybe he gets in, picks up one or two hands fouls as you're making a move on him, and then that's going to inhibit his game going forward. Like, there was nothing done to inhibit his game. He was able to play, and when he's able to play, well, that's the numbers he's going to get you. That's the result they're going to get.
I think, you know, he's known as not a great shooter, or, you know, they prefer to sort of take away the drive. I think he needs that passing pressure as well. I think you need to sort of take him, get him on the back foot a bit, and just not let him have as much space to see the floor in the half court. I had a quick question. There's a guy on Melbourne's bench who I'm really fond of, skill-wise. Venky Joyce.
Yep.
Do you think, on a skill base, do you think if he'd been there from the start of the year, he would be sort of Melbourne's eighth rotation player? The fact that he's joined mid-season, yeah.
Yes, I don't have any doubt. On the flashes that he's been able to show in the minuscule time that he's been able to get, coming in when he did, I think there's no doubt that had he been part of this team from the start, that he would be a very relevant player in what we're talking about. And I hope they have him stitched up, because if they don't have him stitched up beyond this season, I think he'll be just gone up the freeway somewhere there, southeast Melbourne, and playing with the Phoenix. You know, I think they'd be crazy not to be all over him. So I think this young man is somebody we're going to enjoy for a long time to come. But right now, he's not in a position where he's able to show. Yeah, he's in sort of, I wouldn't say survival mode, but he's in just doesn't want to screw up mode at the moment when he does get an opportunity. So, yeah. I'm waiting to see what he brings us in next season and beyond.
I think he's sort of, I don't know if I'm overreaching or hyperbole, but I really think he's sort of borderline starter in the NBL.
Yeah,
depending upon the
team. Absolutely. Cairns should be all over a guy like him
for sure.
Because he's still got the youth and he's got the athleticism, and you know, I think he's going to be something. I couldn't agree more.
Melbourne game three. How do they steal game three? What would be the one or two or three points that are most important for them to get that?
Well, they need that contribution from everybody. They need Barlow hitting those open shots, because I mean that thing, that 3-point shot of his is an ugly thing, isn't it?
It's a weird shot. How do you go up through juniors and the pros and maintain that shot? I would have thought someone would have said, "Nah, you got to change."
I see some sort of raptor dinosaur kind of motion in the way he's doing it. It's an ugly shot, but when it's going down, geez, he's effective. And now if you're a Nick Kay, you've got to come away from your comfort area to come out to him. And so he's an important part of it. The two big guys, I mean, I thought Pledger, I know he didn't play a huge amount of minutes, but I thought he was quite effective in the time he was on the floor. They've got to get the job done on the boards again, and then if they get Casper Ware, Chris Golding and Mitch McCarron rolling, they're in pretty good shape. And again, Kennedy, he would want to be playing another game the way he played game two. Mm. So conversely, for Perth, I'd be wanting to put as much pressure on Kennedy defensively. I would want to be attacking him to see if we can get him in a bit of foul trouble, see if we can force Melbourne now into a new strategy, because you know you can go in with the greatest strategy on earth, you get two quick fouls on somebody and you're now rethinking your game plan.
Totally on the back foot, much like I thought Melbourne were in that game one when McCarron went out with the fouls, and it was a little bit later than perhaps Walker would have hoped, but he sat a lot of the game and just couldn't get his groove when he was in.
No, but I think, in fairness to Mitch, it's his first grand final series, and he's joined the championship team, and he's probably wanting to play out of his skull, and maybe was a little bit over, and you know, like into it a bit too much, and just made a couple of mistakes that he would like to have back. But game two, we saw a much better version of him, and if he can produce that in Perth, well, okay, we've got a game.
I think also for Melbourne, they've just got to push that pace. They looked so good when they were pulling it off the backboard and going. If they get their score up and around the sort of between 90 and 100, I don't think the Wildcats can go with that kind of scoreline.
No, not
as a huge game.
Cotton has to have a huge game, and you've also got to get your bench contributors really contributing again. Like, this is good for Mitch Norton to have another week for him. For him, there's for the rest of us waiting, you know, 5-6 days for a game three is. Yeah, but for him, that's a great thing, and that's going to be an asset to the Wildcats, because it just gives him longer to get back into where he wants to be, and then he can be an effective contributor. Now you've got another guy that's coming off the bench that can actually give you something, as opposed to just hold the fort,
sure.
or go backwards. So, and that he's important. This Oh God, count the days down. Let's get going.
Yeah, no, that's one thing I was going to say as well. Like the 2 week FIBA break before the finals. It's a long time, or almost 2 weeks. I think it's 10 days or something. Long time to go without basketball after the build up of a big regular season, and then you know you just got to wait this time. It feels odd, doesn't it?
It does. You do feel like they lose a little bit of momentum, and the same was the case last year. You felt like they lost a little bit of momentum. Mm-hmm. But realistically, once that ball is thrown up to begin game one, it doesn't matter. The momentum's back. You're right into it. And I think that what we don't see as fans is the benefit that those teams get where they've got a few guys. That was very helpful probably for Mitch Norton, you know, in his comeback from the calf. You know, those sort of things, guys that have got the niggles, that gave them a little bit of a chance. And I thought this time the Boomers handled it well in not taking anybody other than Tommy Wilson from Sydney, but not taking anyone else that was actively involved in the semi-finals. And so, look, it is what it is, and I think the NBL is very gracious in allowing that window and working with Basketball Australia to allow the Boomers to go on. Yeah, you know, it's the same in the AFL now. That they have that week off after the end of the minor round. So be it. We just got to get used to it and buy into it. No one from the teams that are actually involved in the finals complains a lot about it.
Yeah, that makes sense. A bit of a departure, but you've probably seen the sort of follow up to Andre Lemanis' comments about Mika Vekona and the New Zealand national team and their response to sort of the claim that he was forced to play. That seems like a really odd situation where, you know, they said, oh, he was made to play, and they said, well, no, we'd never said that. Have you heard any rumblings about that at all?
No, not a great deal. I mean, you know, everybody wants their players to be available for the national team, and the thing is with Mika is he would have played the next game. He would have played game two if they hadn't restrained him. So who do you blame?
Yeah, true.
You know, it's just unfortunate. I mean, the same thing could have happened to Thomas Abercrombie in the last game of the regular season or something. And then what are we all up in Kevin Braswell's face? You know, I'd let that one go through to the keeper. Yeah,
no problem. Going back to sort of game three and everything, I think Melbourne have actually done a very good job of guarding Cotton. Obviously, his numbers in game one were iffy. Game two was better, hit a couple of threes and stuff. But I think for them, he's not going to the foul line. You look at all his really big games, and you look at really big games in general from any player, they go to the line between sort of 5 and 12 times.
He had 16 free throws in one of the Brisbane games, didn't he?
I think so, yeah. He had a lot. So they're not fouling him. They're almost conceding the three to not give up the quintessential three foul shots to him or four-point plays.
Yep.
Have you been impressed by their defence on Cotton?
Absolutely, I have all season. I know he's had a couple of good returns against them during the course of the regular season, but I think Melbourne are playing him as well as any club has this season, and consistently so. So yeah, I'm quite impressed with that. But you know, Perth still, like, he didn't. Would you say he had a blinder in game one?
No, far from it.
Yeah, and they won. So realistically, a lot of what's been said by the so-called experts about their total reliance on Bryce Cotton, their need for a third import, and all the other rubbish that's put out by people who just can't handle Perth's consistent success. That's what I think is. I think it's just jealousy in the end. So, okay, you can do a great job on Bryce, but he will still find ways to contribute.
Yeah.
He's not going to pout and go, oh, I'm not getting 30, so, you know, I'm. He's not. He's into being a Perth Wildcat. He loves being part of Western Australia's community. He's into it, and he wants to win. So, hats off to Melbourne. They do a good job on him. But before this series is over, he's going to cut out. He's going to get one of those games where he's going to get 36 or 40. It will happen just because of his sheer force of will. So, and if it doesn't, he still will be contributing to his team being successful. That's what makes him an MVP.
No, I agree. Have you seen anything like structurally, though, that Melbourne do? Is it just a simple matter of Casper Ware's a really good defender?
Or they just... Yeah, Casper's into it. Like, he is such a good player. Honestly, I wish he didn't do a couple of the things that players do these days, you know.
The carry-on?
Oh, I know, just the odd flop here and there and throw your feet out. I mean, Bryce does the same thing. Cotton does the same thing, you know, on the three. But why does he get so many four-point players? I mean, are guys defending him just stupid, or is he outsmarting them and the officials?
I honestly think it's because he gets an ungodly elevation on his jump shot. No one else gets that high off the ground on the jump shot. And guys just aren't really prepared for his landing thereafter.
Yeah, but that's okay for a third of a season. But are you not watching the guy play? Are you, you know, like by guys that are going to guard him, are they not watching that? Are they not studying tape and going, well, that's what he does. I've got to be a little mindful, not careful, but mindful of you know. But getting back to the head to head, no, I think Kasper takes a lot of pride. I mean, I know Jerome Randall was injured apparently, which is why he played so poorly in game two of their semi-final. But I also thought. Yeah, I thought Kasper actually really did a number on him, and you've got to take your hats off to Kasper. Like he plays both ends of the court.
He was incredible in that series. He's been good this one. He was incredible against Sydney.
Yeah, and I think they have other strategies into how they double him and when they double him. So yeah, I think Melbourne has done as good a job as any team, if not better. They've done the best job on Bryce Cotton. But that doesn't mean that you're going to beat Perth.
No, in Perth, especially.
Yeah, especially, because, like we've already conceded, game one, you know, that's not one for the Bryce Cotton archives, but you know, he's still doing things.
I think
it's
one for the Nick Kay archives. I thought he was that good. I really did.
Look, I've been a Nick Kay fan since the first time I saw him in the Blitz playing for Townsville, and I think Sean Dennis was coaching at the time, and we're like, who's this kid? You know, he's going to be something.
And this might sound, I think just on an eye test, and this is where I think people sort of overlook it. He's got a unique running style. His hips kind of lock and his feet kind of run together a little bit, and it looks odd, but yeah, he's an athletic player, but if he can free up those hips and run a little bit more fluidly, maybe get more
athletically.
Athletically.
Run a little bit less like an elderly man and a bit more like an athlete. Is that what you're saying?
A little bit. Something like that.
But look, no, I love him and I love his work ethic. I love the way he goes about his game.
Yeah.
There's no BS with him.
No.
You know, if he's hit the deck, it's because someone's barged through his chest, not because someone brushed past him.
Yeah.
You know, he plays both ends of the floor. He just works hard. He's every coach's dream. That's the sort of guy you want. And I don't know this for a fact. I don't know this for a fact, but I'm pretty sure that he'd be very low maintenance. You know, he's not a guy you'd have to worry too much about, like, you know, how you're feeling, you know, is everything all right, you know, all that tenderness that coaches have to show. I think he's the sort of guy that just loves playing, just goes out and does it.
I mean, and what Perth must be pretty lucky about is they've secured a young local, I don't know what his age is, but he's young, local, and presumably they've got him a multi-year, I don't know or not, but that's like, so important in the NBL when your second or third best player is a local, and you've got so much more room with imports.
I think we identified that earlier that the Mitch Norton Nick Kay double was the next stage of the Damien Martin Matt Knight double that originally came from West Sydney. So these guys have come from a little from Illawarra via Townsville. But what you've done is you've really got a successor for Damo and the successor for Matt Knight. So that means now you can find three imports if you need three. Sometimes you can get by with two. They're in great shape going forward. This is like this 33rd. Successive appearance in the playoffs. It's not going to be the last.
No.
You know, as long as you've got that basis to work from, my goodness, I mean, Damo can still be a very effective player as a backup.
And I don't think Damien Martin's gone anywhere. I think he's been really good in this series. Obviously, especially in game one when they won, but he's still got it. And his ability to defend guys and influence games in any number of ways. His shot was a little bit off game two. But yeah, he's had a good series and really, really a joy to watch.
Absolutely, always is. Tell me this, is he out of contract?
Oh, I don't know.
If he is out of contract, it's just a curiosity to me. Mm-hmm. And if Rob Beveridge is to get the Sydney Kings job, as most of us believe...
You think he can go there?
I'm just throwing it up as I wonder if you'll spend any time thinking about that. Bevo being the one, he's the one that got him into the game in the first place. They have really, really good history.
I think so. I think You know, and there'd also be that, Beveridge, Bogut, Damian Martin, Newley, were they all?
Yeah, yes, they were all a part of that team.
I think...
So was Matt Knight. We could drag him out of retirement.
I think there's some thought to be given there. I just think he just adores Perth and they seem to adore
him. Of course he does. Of course he does. And you know, but it's an interesting... It's something to... worth having a chat about if he's out of contract. If he's not out of contract, it's not even worth revisiting because he is a fixture now in Perth, and rightly so.
Yeah. All right. I think that'll kind of do it there. Any questions? Any sort of things from Adelaide going on worth mentioning?
I think the rumour mill is kind of building that Nathan Sobey may well be joining Mitch Creek at the Phoenix. That's been around for a while, and then some time back I heard he was going to sign for 3 years here. But
I did hear a bit of that too. I've heard.
And right. I think, I'm not sure where Joey Wright features in this because I believe, you know, there's been speculation, quite a bit of speculation about Joey, but I suspect he's staying unless he gets an opportunity to coach in the United States. I couldn't see him going anywhere else in this league. So,
and when you say United States, would that be NBA exclusively or college program?
No, I think he'd take a head coach at a good college program. I think he'd take an NBA assistant coach role. I mean, Joey is a coach for life, so he would be looking at his own pathways. But there's no reason that he needs to leave Adelaide, if you get what I mean. Like, he's still got 3 years of his five-year deal to go. So he has no reason. He's got the security of that. So you can also look around, because I'm sure there's an out clause for him involving the United States. So, at this point, I think he will be back. And that was, a couple of weeks ago, the speculation was that he wouldn't be, but I reckon he will be.
Okay. What about Brian Gorgeon all of a sudden coming out of the mist from years of
that's a beauty, but I don't know what to believe in that because I believe what Brian says, and I had contact with Brian 2 years ago in Singapore at the preseason tournament the 36ers played in. He was coaching in that, and we had a chat, and I said to him, like, when are you coming back to Australia? Do you want to come back to Australia? Do you want to come back to the NBL? And the answer was yes, he wants to come back to Australia, and yes, he wants to come back to the NBL. So the next question I asked him, so who would you coach? And he said, so these are his words to me, I would rather be in a front office capacity when I come home. I'd rather be a general manager or a CEO or something of that. So that's where he was looking at going. I thought whether the time involved and invested and being out there on the court, you know, like maybe he's looking at more the Pat Riley role at Miami Heat. Where you've got, and so now imagine that. Ooh. Imagine him at Sydney Kings as the CEO and Rob Beveridge as the coach, and you go, oh my goodness, we could have a dynasty building there for a while.
Definitely.
I don't know if they get 33 years of playoffs, but it would be a great start.
Yeah, no, it's definitely for sure. The thing I was going to say is one thing I want to clarify: Chris Golding, the pronunciation of his surname is Golding, not Goulding. Am I right?
If you say so. I've always thought it was Chris Goulding, and they get it wrong.
Oh, okay. Oh, that's another spanner in the works then. I don't know. I thought it was... Because you get both. In the same telecast, you'll get two pronunciations. I'm going to research into that. I'm going to find out for sure.
Well, I mean, there's a basketball player here in South Australia who was a top wheelchair player for a long time, and his name is spelled Gould, G-O-U-L-D, Gould. So if you add ING on it, it should be Goulding, shouldn't it?
Problem is, I went to school with a Robert Golding. Guess the spelling. You know? That's crazy.
Yeah. And my surname is spelled N-A-G-Y, which is Nagy or Nagy or something. And Hungarian is pronounced Nodge.
Nodge.
Nodge. Like N-O-D-G-E. That's what it would be. Yeah. I can't definitively answer that question, but I can say this, his first name is Chris.
Okay, good. I think we'll just go first name basis there. speaking of which, I meant to sort of say it last time, if I can clarify the pronunciation of your first name, because I've heard it pronounced two different ways, and if I can have a go at it, there's Botty and Boaty. no?
That's wrong and wrong.
Because I was listening to the Derek Rucker podcast, and he used both of those actually at different points.
Look, it doesn't really bother me because it's Boti. Boti, or it's an O sound, and no one who isn't Hungarian can get that right.
Okay.
Hungarians can get it right because it's a Hungarian name. It's like the Rob from Robert. Robert would be okay. Botond. Botond is what it is.
All right, Botond, I'll practice
but it's Botinodge. That's what it is in Hungarian. But yeah, but you know, yeah, near enough is good enough. I'm not fussed. I know it's not. I know it's not John Smith.
Okay. All right. That sounds pretty good to me. All right. Yeah. Body, pleasure. And I will speak to you in the near future.
Look forward to it, Jason.
Yep. Likewise. Ciao.
All the best.
Bye.